cloudy tonight, lows 29 to 34. Chance for mixed precip and sunny tomorrow, highs 44 to 50 with breezy northwest wind.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden. Coming up on As It Happens.
No apologies. As second in command, the late Dick Cheney paved the way for a new kind of Republican politician. Our guest tells us why the former vice president was so unapologetic about making himself the most powerful veep in U.S. history.
And from construction to destruction, a medieval tower in the heart of Rome collapses, killing a man who was working inside. A local tour guide who was nearby tells us she's hoping the incident will be a wake-up call to better preserve the city's ancient buildings.
Those stories and more coming up for you on the Tuesday edition of As It Happens.
There is more ahead from As It Happens in a few minutes here on KAXC. Support comes from the First National Bank of Coleraine since 1906, serving the needs of the community and working with their friends and neighbors. With branches in Coleraine and Grand Rapids, more information at coleranebank.com, member FDIC. Support also comes from the Grassroots Concert Series presenting Kelly Hunt, Friday, November 7th, 7 p.m. at the Live Well Nightclub and Coffee Bar, located at the Journey Church in Nisswa. Doors will open at 6:30. The full fall lineup can be found at grassrootsconcerts.org. We are going to sample our album of the week right now. It's called Get Your Feathers Ready by Blue Moon Marquee and Northern Cree. Blue Moon Marquee is a Canadian blues duo based in a town on Vancouver Island, and Northern Cree is a powwow and round dance drum and singing group from Alberta. These are both Juno Award-winning groups, and Northern Cree is the only traditional Canadian Aboriginal group to have been nominated for a Grammy. As the bands have said, this new collaboration is powwow meets the blues at its finest. The song we'll hear this evening is called Rollin' and Tumblin'.
Rolling a tumble, I've got a
from our album of the week, that is Blue Moon Marquee and Northern Cree, the song called Rollin' and Tumblin', and the album is Get Your Feathers Ready. You can read more about it at KAXE.org, along with other fresh picks of the week from our music team. And let us know what you think. Text us 218-326-1234.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
Good evening, I'm Chris Howden. This is As It Happens. Tonight,
the Liberals brag that their brand new budget is big and bold. Opposition leaders have some less positive adjectives to describe it. Conservative House Leader Andrew Scheer gives us his take on the budget and the defection of one of his party's MPs.
Thank you kindly. One of the big winners in today's federal budget is the Canadian military. We'll ask a defense analyst if this new financial attention compensates for what he feels were years of neglect.
Culinary heads prevail. Kelowna is the first Canadian city to be named a UNESCO Creative City of Gastronomy. A First Nations chief pushed for that title and says he is savoring the success.
Vice Grip, a journalist who wrote several books about the late Dick Cheney, reflects on how the most powerful vice president in American history wanted to be remembered and how he'll actually be remembered.
Make it so. The next stop on this week's Hometown series is Vulcan, Alberta, where they leaned into their inadvertent Star Trek connection, sat back and watched the Spocks fly.
And no dining, but so much whining. Scientists have finally discovered precisely how mosquitoes court and have sex, and all it took was staring at close-up footage frame by frame in agonizing slow motion for literally hundreds of hours. As it happens, the Tuesday edition, radio that's proud to announce no more guesstimating. The expectations for today's federal budget were sky high, and the government was responsible for those expectations with all the talk about how big and bold it would be and the portentous remarks about generational investments. And today Canadians are learning about the budget the Prime Minister promised would, quote, define our next century, unquote. The highlights, some big spending. $141 billion, to be exact, over the next 5 years. The recipients include the military, to the tune of $81.8 billion, and a $51 billion infrastructure program, with cash being funneled into roads, ports, parks, and transit. And to help pay for all of that new spending, there are major cuts totaling $51.2 billion. The bureaucracy will be slashed by nearly 40,000 jobs. But before the budget gets passed, at least a few opposition MPs will have to vote to support it. And right as we were going to air tonight, Conservative MP Chris D'Entremont dropped a bombshell, resigning from Conservative caucus. Andrew Scheer is the Conservative opposition House leader, and we reached him in Ottawa.
Andrew Scheer, I have to start with the breaking news about your colleague or former colleague, perhaps I should say, Chris D'Entremont. Have you spoken to him?
Yeah, I have. It was pretty disappointing, you know. Mr. D'Entremont has looked at the massive amounts of debt and deficit that Mark Carney is telling Canadians they're going to have to sacrifice to pay off. And then I guess he put up his hand and said, sounds great to me, but it doesn't make any sense, because just a few months ago, he was promising his constituents that he would fight inflation, he would fight big government bureaucracy and restore hope for young Canadians and working class Canadians. And he's effectively turned his back at all the people that he promised he'd fight for in the last election.
He must be hearing from his constituents as well. And perhaps, you know, was it the possibility of this not passing and the possibility of another federal election that swayed him as well? Did he say anything like that to you?
I believe it had more to do with the fact that he wasn't successful in being elected deputy speaker.
You think it's sour grapes?
Yeah, he's had some personal grievances ever since then. He was quite upset about that, and he did a poor job of hiding it. And so I don't think it really had anything to do with principle. I think it more had to do with his own inability to get over a personal grievance on something internal, which is really disappointing to the thousands of constituents in his riding who were desperately looking for some hope that Conservatives were offering for. I'm picturing all the people who dug deep into their wallets to make donations to his campaign, believing that he was going to go and fight for the things he ran on, and he's effectively betrayed all those people. So he'll have to explain to his constituents why he betrayed them, why he took their votes in April, and then let personal grievances cloud his judgment.
Well, we hope to speak and have him back on the show as well. We spoke right after the election, and so we hope to get more of his take of why he decided to make the move that he has. In terms of the budget itself, you know, it was not, perhaps it wasn't likely that your party was going to support it, given, you know, just the idea of a $42 billion deficit. Now we're talking about a $78 billion deficit. Was that the deciding factor?
Well, it's really staggering when you think about it, eh? I mean, Justin Trudeau was racking up these massive deficits that was causing inflation and chasing away investment from our economy. And Mark Carney looked at that and said, hold my beer, you know, and buckle up, because those massive, gigantic deficits have turned into ginormous deficits. I think even in the metric system, ginormous is a pretty big number. I'm just so worried about how young Canadians are going to be able to pay all this back. You know, Mark Carney gave a very gloomy, bleak speech a couple of weeks ago where he was warning people they'd have to sacrifice even more. And now we see what that sacrifice is going to, like a massive expansion in the federal government. I think there's something like 14 or 15 new programs, $25 billion in more spending, the deficit almost doubling. Just to put that in perspective now, under Mark Carney, more of your tax dollar, more of your listeners' tax dollars are going to go to the interest on the national debt than the government spends on healthcare. I mean, that's just staggering at a time when so many Canadians can't find family doctors, where, you know, people are waiting sometimes days in emergency rooms, knowing that their working class Canadians' tax dollars are going to pay bankers and bondholders instead of improving things like healthcare. I mean, this is just going to be a crippling debt for generations of Canadians to come.
The government, as you know, says that the spending is justified. Investing in infrastructure is necessary, given, you know, concerns about a sluggish economy, concerns about U.S. tariffs, the impact of job losses to the U.S. What choice did the government have? Don't they need to invest right now to spur growth in the economy and make up for what we're losing as our relationship with the United States falters, to say the least?
Well, first of all, I must point out that the situation with U.S. tariffs is even worse with Mark Carney than it was in the previous prime minister's tenure. There are more tariffs from more countries on more things under Mark Carney, and that's all been since he's become prime minister. And remember, he promised to fix all this. He said he was the guy you hire in a crisis and that he would deliver. So, and I also don't believe that you can justify massively expanding the deficit and placing all that burden on Canadian taxpayers for that. The government cannot backfill what the economy loses from all its policies that chase away that investment. So, for example, they announced in this budget they're going to increase the industrial carbon tax. How is that going to help our steel and aluminum exporters who are already hit by U.S. tariffs, knowing that the federal government's going to make that industrial carbon tax even worse for them? And it just doesn't make any sense.
Is it going to make it worse from the scrapping the emissions cap? I would think that perhaps your party would be in favor of where they're going with that.
Sure.
They're likely to scrap the emissions cap, I should say.
If that's all they did, you know, we'd certainly be look on that favorably. But you know, in the same budget, they're talking. Their justification for removing the production cap was that because they're doing all these other measures like increasing the fuel standards that's going to add 17 cents a liter on gas, increasing the industrial carbon tax. I mean, these are all measures that, you know, they're just raising with one hand more than what they're offering in relief with the other. So again, it's cold comfort to Canadians seeing that they're going to increase the very things that chase the very taxes and regulations that chase away those investments that create jobs here in Canada. Mark Carney's going to raise.
They're also making cuts within this budget. As you know, the public sector, we've talked about, you know, as well, our listeners have heard throughout the coverage. Are there areas that you and your party, the Conservatives, would have liked to see more cuts?
Well, what we were saying is that, you know, rather than spending billions of dollars on bureaucracy, for example, they have all these creative programs with names that seem to change every 12 months or so for things like housing. Well, all of that has increased the cost of housing. You know, development charges haven't come down, so more bureaucrats get paid. They've hired somebody to run a major projects office that's making $500,000. Not a single new project has actually been underway. Mark Carney's been prime minister now for, you know, we're almost at the 1 year anniversary. Just a couple months I've been prime minister for a year, not a single shovel in the ground for any of these major projects. So what we've seen in the last few months is massive increases in bloated bureaucracies without any results for Canadians. And I don't know how you can say that they're making cuts when the deficit's bigger.
Well, they are. I mean, they are making cuts to the
public. But overall, the deficit's bigger. Sure. Program expenses are higher. The federal debt is going to increase. Mark Carney is saying he's going to add over $300 billion in the national debt.
Andrew Scheer, much more to discuss, but we do have to leave it there. I really appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Andrew Scheer is the Conservative opposition House leader. We reached him in Ottawa. The most significant, lasting part of his legacy is the War on Terror and the resulting deaths of hundreds of thousands of people. And former U.S. Vice President Dick Cheney never apologized for that.
Any regrets about going into Iraq?
No, it was the right thing to do then. I believed it then and I believe it now.
No apologies.
No apologies.
Former U.S. Vice President Dick Cheney reflecting on his role in the invasion of Iraq in a 2016 CNN interview with Jamie Gangle. Dick Cheney died yesterday. He was 84. John Nichols is the executive editor of The Nation and the author of the biography, The Rise and Rise of Richard B. Cheney, Unlocking the Mysteries of the Most Powerful Vice President in American History. We reached Mr. Nichols in San Francisco.
John, no regrets, no apologies. Dick Cheney said then in 2016, there were no weapons of mass destruction. We know everything that came after the invasion of Iraq, but no regrets, no apologies. What was it that drove Dick Cheney, knowing what you know about him?
I mean, the thing to understand about Dick Cheney is that, you know, he's a relative small town guy from out in the middle of the country who, you know, through a lot of hard work, maybe a little conniving, made it to the top of power in the United States. I mean, literally defining both his party and his country for the better part of a half century. And so you don't get there with a lack of confidence. And I think the bottom line to understand about Dick Cheney is that he very early on established himself as a sort of no apologies politician. Mm-hmm. Now, if you hear a little bit of a sense of Donald Trump in that, you know, somebody who also doesn't like to make apologies or seem weak in any setting, I think that's accurate. The fact of the matter is that Cheney, in many ways, created a modern Republican Party that did present itself as unapologetic.
And paving the way to perhaps where we are today. He also, as you all know and have written about, he changed the vice presidency like no one before him, and the presidency as well. How would you describe to people who weren't present at that time or may not remember just how monumental those shifts were?
From the very beginning, there was an understanding that Dick Cheney was going to run a lot of stuff because he knew how to do it. Bush would be out front, but Cheney would be more than just a typical vice president. What we didn't know at the time was that Dick Cheney would, for a variety of reasons, assert himself even more aggressively than we had ever seen a vice president do before. And that did create real tensions, ultimately, because there was a suggestion that Cheney was running the country and Bush was sort of, you know, off playing golf or doing something else.
But ultimately, they did run together a second time.
Yes, of course.
W saying that he respect, you know, he valued the friendship, at least publicly. He was saying he valued the friendship and the council. But as you did your work and you've written these books, as our listeners heard, in terms of the invasion of Iraq, the use of torture, the Patriot Act. There's so many moments in history that he has been a part of, an architect of, controversial moments. What did you learn about just how involved he was in those decisions?
These decisions were made with Dick Cheney either directly at the table or sometimes in certain circumstances, even beyond that in a situation where he was really sort of running some aspects of what was done. And I don't think there is any question whatsoever that the certainty with which the Bush-Cheney administration asserted that there were weapons of mass destruction without proof and asserted that torture was necessary and that it was authorized and appropriate, all these things, that came from Cheney.
Ultimately, back to what I was asking earlier, was it a desire for power or control, love of country, maybe all of those things in his mind? What do you think was at the heart of it for him?
I think that Dick Cheney really liked to have power. He sought it from the earliest days of his involvement in politics. When he was in the House of Representatives, he wanted to be the Speaker of the House. After he was Secretary of Defense, he did go around the country trying to position himself to be president. This is a guy who wanted to be in charge. That's where it gets more complex. Why do you want to be in charge? Is it simply for power? Is it because you believe you could do it better than anybody else? How does that intersect with patriotism and all sorts of other factors? At the end of the day, I think that Dick Cheney was a realpolitik political figure. He was somebody who believed it was a very tough, very dangerous world out there, and that you needed a tough guy, a very hard guy in there who would do unpleasant and even unpopular things. And I do believe, I don't think there's much question, that he saw himself as that individual for the United States in that time. And as a result, he led the United States, obviously with Bush, also, but they led the United States into a war that ultimately proved to be immensely unpopular. At the end of the day, they created an administration that was immensely unpopular to the point where they lost their congressional majorities. And then also they got so bad at the end that in 2008, they weren't even showing up at Republican events. Nobody wanted them around. Cheney's personal popularity fell to an incredibly low level. And yet, Cheney, I don't think that bothered Cheney too much. It might have bothered Bush some, but I don't think it bothered Cheney too much.
Finally, John, how do you think Dick Cheney wanted to be remembered, and how do you think he actually will be?
I think he would like to have been remembered as a strong leader in a dangerous world. I think he will be remembered. I think it's going to be a rough memory. The war in Iraq is not something people forget about in much of the world. I think that the torture practices that he defended are ones that even many of his fellow Republicans, people like John McCain, condemned. And there will be a lot of reassessments of Cheney. And I have to be honest, I think that George W. Bush, who released a nice statement today, at the end of the day, there will be a lot of people who sort of parse the Bush-Cheney administration and tend to come away from it saying, well, whatever you might have liked about it, that was probably Bush. Whatever you didn't like, that was probably Cheney.
John, I'm glad we could speak. Thank you for this.
It's a pleasure to talk to you.
John Nichols is the author of the biography, The Rise and Rise of Richard B. Cheney, Unlocking the Mysteries of the Most Powerful Vice President in American History. We reached him in San Francisco. Former U.S. Vice President Dick Cheney died yesterday at the age of 84. They were there to do construction in a medieval tower, but somehow the building self-destructed. People in Rome were shaken yesterday when part of a 13th century tower called Torre de' Conti collapsed, sending dust and debris through one of the city's busiest tourist areas. One of the contractors was trapped inside. After 11 hours of painstaking rescue work, he was pulled from the rubble, but he died of his injuries in hospital. Now prosecutors in Italy have opened a manslaughter investigation into the death of 66-year-old Octave Stroici. Kate Parkinson is a freelance tour guide in Rome. She was nearby when the tower collapsed and rushed over to see the aftermath. We reached her in Rome.
Kate, what were you doing? Where were you when you realized that something was wrong?
I'd actually been touring on the Caelian Hill, which is just behind the Colosseum, and I'd been visiting some Roman houses that are under the church there, St. John and Paul, and I came out and I saw a video on my sort of guide chat, if you like, and so I was in the area, so I just, you know, went over there and I saw the billowing dust and realized what was happening.
Yeah, and did you see
any... It was quite terrifying, actually, because it looked like it was actually all going to come down.
What is standing today?
The tower is not completely destroyed. There was some reinforcements from the 14th century on the side that basically came down, but there'd been also some rubble that had come down, and so they were basically trying to clear that rubble when the second, more dangerous and more worrying. There's been a lot of talk since it happened about the fact that there were, like a lot of buildings around the city, vegetation that was compromising the masonry that hadn't been looked at for 100 years. There were previous projects to restore the tower that hadn't happened. So there were some issues. But yes, we were all concerned in general, many of us, about the whole area around the tower, because the tower is basically built on top of what used to be the Forum of Peace, which dates to the late first century. And it's right adjacent to the Roman Forum. And that whole area is, at the moment, there's a underground tunnel being dug for the extension of the metro system. So we have underground trains, and the Metro C is being extended from the Colosseum all the way to St. Peter's. And so a lot of us have been very concerned about that.
About whether that might be destabilizing things?
Yes, and well, most of us are pretty sure that that is the case.
We don't know for sure. You know, certainly there's an investigation.
There's an investigation, and, you know, structural engineers obviously will be, you know, called in to review everything. But it certainly was something that we were all very concerned about.
In terms of how the people you work with, tourists, how are they reacting? How has it impacted the work that you do?
So I think quite a lot of the tourists were pretty shocked, to be honest. We actually often, if we're doing a private tour and we have a car or a minivan, that's exactly where we meet, the minivan, you know, right next to the tower. So it's an area that we, when we come out of the Roman Forum, we cross the road and the tower's right there. So that was concerning. You know, one of the bars next door has been closed down. Colleagues were telling me that all the buses were not going to that area. They were basically rerouted around the Circus Maximus, where the chariot races used to be.
Because it is right in the middle of the city, just to place it for people again, if they haven't been to Rome. Yeah,
so basically you have what we call the historic city, which is the medieval, Renaissance, Baroque, modern city that backs onto Piazza Venezia, and then from there you have all of the ancient things. And this is right in the center of that. So you're really in the heart of Rome.
Everything you've described is part of what makes Rome such a beloved city for visitors and locals. But I was struck by some of the quotes I was reading in the reporting, including in the Guardian. There was a pharmacist in Rome, and you know, she just talked about how fragile the city feels. And that this is one example underlining that for her. You've lived in Rome for some time. Does it feel that way?
Yes, because every now and again something like this does happen. And we, you know, we're a city literally right next to my apartment. There's a first century AD or CE catacomb right below. So literally we're just on top of ancient things, and every now and again, you know, something opens up or there's a road work being done and they find a bit of ancient road, and the maintenance is a bit of an issue, to be honest. There's always so much to do and not enough is done in terms of maintenance. So sadly it takes things like this happening to put the spotlight on, you know, some of the maintenance that really needs to be done.
The Torre de Conti is damaged, but a life was lost, as you well know, and people are dealing
Absolutely.
With that as well. So do you get the sense that this incident might bring about the kind of change that could keep others safer?
Well, that's always the hope in this situation. it's a terrible loss of life. It's a very sad thing when somebody, you know, is working in construction, 66 years old, close to retirement age, and, you know, dies in this way. It's just so tragic. So one does hope, yes, that this will mean that the mayor and, you know, the Minister for Culture and the Archaeological Superintendency, that they all closely control other things and hope that a tragic accident like this doesn't happen again.
Kate, I appreciate this. Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome.
Kate Parkinson is a freelance tour guide in Rome. That's where we reached her. This sound, but think about how a female mosquito feels. To us, it's just an annoying whine, but to them, it's an annoying whine that says, if I told you you had a beautiful thorax, would you hold it against me? Scientists know that male mosquitoes are constantly trying to mate with females. They also know that most female mosquitoes only mate once in their entire 2 to 3 week lives. So how does it work? Well, figuring that out would mean watching mosquitoes mate, and that is a challenge. I don't want to shame anyone, but for one thing, it only lasts an average of 14 seconds. And for another, and again, no shame, mosquito genitals are vanishingly tiny. So the scientists glued a female mosquito's legs to a pin so she couldn't move much. They sent some males into the enclosure with her, and using an incredibly fancy high-resolution camera, they filmed the sexy results. Now, a lot of people were involved, but I'm only going to name one person, the hero of this research, Leah Hori-Zeevi. According to Nature magazine, she spent hundreds of hours looking at the videos frame by frame. That is hundreds of hours of staring at and thoroughly documenting the precise sexual behavior of mosquitoes and their minuscule genitalia, which is how we learned that, in fact, female mosquitoes are entirely in charge. If they want to get busy for the one time in their lives, they minutely extend their genitals. And if they're not, they don't. And the males have another reason to whine. Reaching this conclusion took a superhuman focus. So we salute this as an example of phenomenal science and junk science, like tiny junk science. Here's Nina Simone with Funkier Than a Mosquito's Tweeter.
Story. Clean up your rap, your story's getting dusty. Wash out your mouth, your lies are getting rusty. Can't believe nothing you say, 'cause I'm around and I see what you do. You know you're funkier than a mosquito's tweeter. You got a mouth like a herd of boll weavers. Same old game, same old thing. You never change, always rapping about the same old thing.
Simone with Funkier Than a Mosquito's Tweeter.
We are going to take a short break now. When we return, a trip to the prairies for our latest Hometown Edition.
All week, we're bringing you to small communities across Canada where big things are happening. And today, we will go to Vulcan, Alberta to find out what's being done to make big oil pay its taxes and to meet the biggest steer in the world. Stay tuned. I'm Chris Howden.
And I'm Neil Kirksall.
You blew your chance, that's why you never last. You wanna be a graduated mother, but in reality you're just another brother. You think you slip.
Thanks for listening to As It Happens on People Powered KAXE. Good evening, I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up at 7 o'clock, Sarah, your volunteer host for On the River. She'll bring you a great mix of music. More great music continues at 10 o'clock on Headwaters with Malachi Coons. Today features a conversation with Brainerd area musician Kelly Smith. Support comes from Headwaters Unitarian Universalist Fellowship in Bemidji, gathering at 10 a.m. Sundays now through May at the Headwaters Peace Center. HUF is an inclusive space to seek truth, practice love, and celebrate life. Learn more at headwatersuu.org. We also thank Paul Bunyan Communications, powered by the GigaZone, a broadband cooperative featuring all fiber optic GigaZone internet speeds up to 10 gig and local customer service. Learn more at paulbunyan.net. Chance of mixed precipitation tonight, lows 29 to 34, and sunny tomorrow, highs 44 to 50. We continue with As It Happens.
Hello again and welcome back. I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden. This is As It Happens, the Tuesday edition, part two. Coming up,
home delivery, day two of our hometown series, and this visit reveals legal battles, local lore, and some legendary characters.
Today we beam down to a prairie town of 1700, Vulcan, Alberta, a down-to-earth spot with a far-out title, the official Star Trek capital of Canada.
Oil for naught. The Riva Vulcan says one problem has been plaguing the town for almost a decade now: unpaid taxes from energy companies. And we're talking about such huge amounts that the town has actually had to forego fixing roads.
Plus, horns of plenty. Meet the Vulcan cow named Beef, who holds the new Guinness World Record for world's tallest steer. His owner fills us in on how Beef fills himself up on mountains of hay and, at this time of year, every pumpkin in town.
And even a decade after its release, a haunting song about the town is a favorite of fans of the band, The Rural Alberta Advantage. The songwriter tells us he wrote it without even knowing about his own Vulcan roots.
That's all coming right up on the Vulcan Alberta edition of our hometown series here on As It Happens. So stick around. Doing anything else would be highly illogical. The prairie town of Vulcan sits on Highway 23 in southern Alberta, between Lethbridge and Calgary, about 3 hours from the U.S. border crossing to Montana. For years, it was known for what locals called the Nine in a Line, a row of grain elevators that stood tall on the flatlands, until the last of them came down just this year. Vulcan was named after the Roman god of fire by a CP railway surveyor around 1910. But the name took on a whole new meaning in the late 60s, when the world was introduced to the second in command of the Starship Enterprise.
Science Officer Spock, reporting as ordered, Captain.
That, of course, Mr. Spock, a Vulcan who hails from the fictional planet Vulcan, and the very real town of Vulcan, Alberta, ran with that connection, building a massive replica of the Enterprise in the heart of the town and hosting both a Spock-themed parade and a Star Trek convention every year. The town's enthusiasm even caught the attention of Conan O'Brien when he spoke to a local on his podcast.
You're telling me that the town is leaning into it, right? And it has a Star Trek theme? To be honest with you, I'm from Kirk, Massachusetts, and we didn't lean into this at all. You guys are from Vulcan, and you lost your mind. This is unbelievable to me that a town has surrendered its dignity like this. This is absolutely incredible.
Leonard Nimoy himself, the late actor who, of course, brought Spock to life, told the town what their affection meant to him when he made a homecoming visit of sorts back in 2010 after leading a successful campaign to make Vulcan Canada's official Star Trek capital.
I have had an extraordinary experience being identified with the Spock character. I've had opportunities to work all over the world, all across Canada, all across the United States. In all of these experiences, I have never had an experience quite as touching as I'm having here today, and I appreciate it. Thank you.
Jason Schneider has waved to the crowds at the Spock Days parades year after year. He has seen the nine in a line fall, provincial governments come and go, and he's been fighting the same fight year after year, both as the Reeve of Vulcan County and as one of the directors of the organization Rural Municipalities of Alberta. He wants to collect unpaid taxes worth millions across rural Alberta, the taxes that oil and gas companies owe to municipalities. Speaking to community leaders in March, Premier Danielle Smith promised to tackle the problem.
Alberta is extremely fortunate for our oil and natural gas wealth, but it's unacceptable when delinquent companies aren't paying their municipal taxes. When our government sees that $220 million in unpaid taxes are being reported by municipalities, with $130 million in arrears and $90 million in cancellations, it's just not acceptable. And there needs to be real consequences. The new directive creates a condition where companies will not be able to transfer or get new well licenses unless the regulators are satisfied that the taxes have been paid. And we hope that this is just enough of a stick.
We reached Vulcan County Reeve Jason Schneider in Vulcan, Alberta.
Reeve Schneider, you were there when the premier said those words. Is this enough of a stick? Is something new happening here, or is this just deja vu for you?
Well, unfortunately, it's not enough of a stick. We see the problem continuing to happen. And there's currently $100 million of outstanding taxes by operating oil and gas companies in the province. So unfortunately, it's not enough. It has maybe lessened the problem a little bit, but we still have an outstanding problem that needs to be resolved, and we think we need a little bit bigger hammer in our toolbox.
What would that hammer be? I mean, what has helped so far? You said there's a little bit of improvement.
Well, it makes it a little more difficult for companies to move these wells around. What usually ends up happening is they'll pay off the taxes, move them into a shell company, and then carry on their merry way without paying any additional taxes. So we really feel, and we've maintained, that it needs to be the same as royalties. If a company fails to pay the royalties to the province, they're shut down immediately. They lose their operating license, and until they get back into the right side of the royalties, they are not allowed to operate. We feel municipal taxes should be the same. Yeah. And we think that's the hammer that finally solves this problem once and for all.
It's I know it's probably mind-boggling for people there, but for people outside of Vulcan as well. I mean, if someone, wherever they live, didn't pay their property taxes year after year, there would be ways to deal with it as a municipality. Why aren't you able to do that with these oil and gas producers?
Well, ultimately, most of them are all on leased land, if not the vast majority. So your recourse is very limited as to what you can actually put a lien onto. What also happens is these companies, it's a great way of dumping assets that aren't very productive. There's a lot of these wells that have been used for 50, 60 years, and now they're starting to find environmental liabilities and things of that nature. So the companies are happy to let them go into the Orphan Well Association or just kind of walk away from the liabilities. So that's why this problem has been happening since 2015. And this is the fourth premier who's acknowledged it. Yet we're still not seeing a whole lot of action on it. And it's incredibly frustrating.
I was going to say, is that the right word to describe how you're feeling? And I'm sure people are stopping you all the time to talk about things. Maybe you're having a cup of coffee in a restaurant and they ask you a lot of questions. What do you say to them? If it's frustrating for you, it must be frustrating for them as well.
Yeah, a lot of landowners are extremely frustrated as well because typically these companies don't pay their surface leases to the owners either. And in some circumstances, it was, they didn't even really want the well there. But in Alberta, if a oil company wants to enter your land and drill a well, you really can't stop them. So landowners are feeling the same. Then it's also a lot of these bad actors are also taking down, service companies as well. As they kind of continue to operate, continue to make money off Alberta's resources, but aren't doing their fair share and being bad actors in this game.
What specifically would you like the premier to do next that hasn't been done previously? I mean, we hear governments all the time, and yours, your provinces included, say, they're there to protect Albertans and the interests of Albertans. You're saying that people who may not have even wanted these things on their land are also not getting paid. So what do you want the premier to do?
I think the premier needs to make to force the AER to do their job. We have a regulator who has world-class regulations, but doesn't actually force companies to adhere to them. And, you know, there's a lot of good operators out there. I'm not trying to paint the entire industry with one brush, but there's a lot. There are bad actors out there. And I think for the sake of the industry, and I think for the sake of Albertans, we need to actually do a better job of regulating and not trying to be more of a cheerleader as the AER has seemed to been in the last 10 years.
The reality is unpaid taxes means less tax revenue for you to do what needs to be done and address the needs of people in your community. So what kinds of choices does that force you to make?
Yeah, so Vulcan County, we're not a big municipality. We're about 4,200 people, and we are owed almost $13 million of unpaid oil and gas taxes. We've had to make some pretty serious cuts. We've had to reduce our service level. We've had to eliminate some positions. It's been very difficult when these companies are still making money and are still operating and are almost flaunting it in our face while we are asking our ratepayers to make up for the taxes that they're not paying. It's not a fun conversation to have, and it's really broken the trust between rural residents and oil and gas companies.
Vulcan, our listeners may not know, is home to Canada's largest solar power plant. You have a huge wind power facility about to open. You must be thinking about those facilities as well. Is the province responsive about your concerns when it comes to those newer projects?
Much more responsive. We have definitely had those conversations. And, you know, all of these projects, regardless of what industry are, they have a finite lifespan. Wind and solar is kind of estimated at that 25-year lifespan. And so in 25 years, we don't want to be cleaning up a mess for a company that's skipped town. So the province has been very receptive on with that industry.
Why do you think there is that sort of double standard, really, at this stage?
Well, I think that oil and gas is you know, the big industry in Alberta. Obviously, I think, you know, they pay a lot of royalties, and we have a government who currently is a little short on revenues. So I think they are really worried about doing anything that's going to be perceived as anti-oil and gas, and that's really unfortunate for the good operators who are doing the right things. Mm-hmm. They're big you know, supporters of communities, and you know, they're generating a lot of revenue at a local level. I think it's getting hard for them to operate because of these bad actors.
Reeve Schneider, I'm glad we could speak. Thank you for this.
You bet. Thank you.
Jason Schneider is the Reeve of Vulcan County, Alberta. We reached him in the town of Vulcan. Well, now that we've met the Reeve, we turn to another notable resident of Vulcan County, one who stands more than an inch taller than Michael Jordan and weighs as much as a small car. His name is Beef, and you'll find him listed in the Guinness Book of World Records under World's Tallest Steer. He grew and grew and grew into the stately creature he is today on the Triple H farm in Vulcan County, and his owner, Jasmine Entz, had big plans for Beef before he could even stand on his own 4 feet. We reached Ms. Entz in Vulcan County.
Jasmine, you were there when Beef was born. Did you have plans and hopes and dreams for Beef even then?
My biggest hope and dream for him at that time was that I was looking for a steer to ride eventually.
What?
So, yeah, like I was actively looking for a bull calf that I thought was extra cute and smart and friendly, and he checked all my boxes, so... Yeah, when he was born, it was kind of just a aha moment that, you know, I saw him laying there and I thought, yep, that's the one that I'm going to take home.
Why did you want to have a steer that you could ride?
That's a good question. Mm. I don't have an answer. I don't know. I must have saw a video at some point somewhere. Right. I had it in my head for a long time that a cow would be fun and different to ride, and so that was a dream that I had thought up at some point, and it actually, as it turns out, cows make much better riding animals than people think they do.
Interesting. What's better about it?
They're a lot smoother. They're a lot less reactive than horses. They don't spook at things. They want to check everything out.
The controversies they're stoking right now. I can imagine the letters we're going to get, the emails we're going to get. I'm looking forward to those. But did you get to ride Beef at some point?
Yeah, I did. Yep. Yeah. Yeah. When he was about a year and a half old, I broke him to ground drive. We never actually like pulled a cart or anything, but right. I would just walk behind him. And so we started this training when he was young. And then when he turned two, we put the saddle on him and we rode him for that first summer or so. We would ride out in pasture and check cows and stuff on him. And he was always super excited to go out on adventures. And he handled it really, really well. And then he, over that winter, outgrew all of my horse pack. So I just never got back on. Of course, I had dreams and stuff of getting custom tack built and everything else, but it just never happened. So
do you get the sense that Beef is disappointed that era, that part of his life is over?
I don't know. Like we still go out on walks and stuff and he gets to explore that way. It's just not under saddle anymore.
Understood. And how do the other cows react to his special place? I mean,
you got a lot of strange looks.
I bet. But back to the newborn bit, because I've seen pictures of Beef now, and I'll get you to describe what Beef looks like now. But as a newborn, what did Beef look like?
Like, I would say average weight, average height. He has always been kind of spindly and awkward built, you know, narrow, knock-kneed. I was hopeful that he would grow out of that, and then he never did, so.
So what is average for a steer, like, when he was born? What's average?
For a Holstein bull calf, your average is probably about 80 pounds.
Okay. Tiny. Tiny. Wee little thing. And now?
Yeah, like knee height.
And now?
And now he is 6'6" and 2,500 pounds.
Did the name Beef come instantly? I mean, you didn't know he was going to turn into this, right?
No, I that was one of those things that was kind of just always in my head for some reason. I had wanted, like, I was raised in the city, and for some reason it was always in my head that I would have a black cow named Beef, and I thought that was the funniest thing. And then, yeah, when he was born, it was just like, you know what, this strangely suits him for some reason.
Yeah.
So it was never that he was intended to eat. He was always just supposed to be a pet, and it was more of like a humor thing that guided that name.
Yeah. And, I mean, for a lot of people, a steer that size would be intimidating. Clearly, you already have this amazing relationship. There's a great photograph of the both of you on our website that gives us a hint of what Beef's personality is like. But how would you describe it to someone who's never hung out with Beef? What his personality is like?
The first word that comes to mind when I think of him is gentle. He really, you know, like, he does go out and play, and he does get kind of rambunctious every once in a while, but it's typically with our other cow, and it's almost never with, you know, around people. Like, usually he just settles right into cuddling, and, like, he just loves being pet.
The logistics, clearly you love Beef and you go out on the walks, as you mentioned, you've known him since he was a newborn, but the logistics of taking care of a cow this size, what are they? How do you handle all that?
So he just gets whatever I've got available. He eats about 100 pounds a day. Oof. Of hay. It equates to about $400 a month.
Worth every penny for you?
Yes. Would I do it again? No. I will not be getting another Holstein steer, but he is obviously the exception because we've had him since he was born. And
How old is Beef now?
He's a special guy. He's 8.
Okay. All that hay, that's the regular diet. What about treats?
Pumpkins are his favorite, but pretty well any fruits or veggies or bread products. He ate an egg one time, like a raw egg, but I don't think he would do that again.
Likes to try a little, like, just venture, you know.
Yeah, he's not fussy. He'll sample anything. Like full heads of lettuce, he just eats like it's a one-bite brownie.
Just must be fun to watch him.
Yeah, it's pretty entertaining. And he just soaks it all up. Like, new environments, new people, he does not mind at all. The more attention he gets, the better.
Well, security downstairs and our team might not want me to say this, but Beef is welcome in our studio anytime. I'm imagining it right now, and it's making me so happy.
I have a hard time unless you've got special doors. I don't know that he'd fit in there, but...
You make dreams come true, Jasmine. I've heard you talk about it, so I don't know. We'll see. Real pleasure speaking with you, Jasmine, and congratulations to you and Beef.
Thank you.
Jasmine Entz is the owner of Beef, the world's tallest steer. We reached her at the Triple H Farm in Vulcan County, Alberta. Well, that almost wraps things up for today's hometown edition of As It Happens. Tomorrow, we'll be heading to St. Thomas, Ontario. But before we say live long and prosper to Vulcan, Alberta, we need to share a song with some particular relevance. It's by the band The Rural Alberta Advantage, and it's called Vulcan AB. Like the town, the song is quirky and sweet and a little mysterious. It sounds like the kind of song that must have a story behind it. Nels Edenloff is the lead singer of the Rural Alberta Advantage and the man who wrote Vulcan AB. We reached him in Toronto.
Nels, you and your band, you released the song more than a decade ago now. It's still on your set list. Your audience loves it. It's a huge fan favorite still. You had never been to Vulcan, as I understand it, when you wrote the song, right?
Yeah, no, I was well aware of it for having grown up in Alberta. But I didn't actually have a chance to make it down there until we actually shot the video after making the song.
I was just watching it again. What inspired you to write it?
Well, it's funny where these ideas kind of come from initially. So Paul is a huge Star Trek fan. Mm-hmm. And so back in the day when we were kind of starting out playing shows, he had a birthday party that was Star Trek inspired. And he was having all these bands playing. And so this idea was like, oh, there's a city in Alberta called Vulcan. We should, write a song around it. They've got the Enterprise. I can't remember for the life of me if we actually got the song together for that, but the idea was kind of planted there. And then as I was kind of like working out the ideas, it eventually kind of came together. So these things kind of start in weird places, but you harvest them when you can.
As you said, you grew up in Alberta. So what does your family think about the song?
They're always, supportive of the music and, one thing that was interesting, though, was after we had written the song, I was showing my family the whole album, and that's when my dad mentioned, he's like, oh, your grandma actually, she grew up in Vulcan.
What?
And it was one of those things that so my grandma had passed long before, like, my mom had even met my dad. So it was one of those things where I was like, oh, wow, I didn't really know that. I guess it brings me a little bit closer to knowing her, even though I never would have met her.
Nels, I'm glad we could speak. Thank you for this.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
Oh, the night under those old prairie skies, is a lonely heart like yours is breaking mine. In my life, I've been about as far as I'll climb, and the winter's hiding our desire lines. But I'm gonna wake you up, gonna break you out, gonna steal your heart, gonna save you now, gonna try, gonna fight, gonna forget how. Break your heart, gonna grow up now. Gonna try, gonna fight, gonna look up now. Oh, you and me in the Enterprise, stuck in Vulcan Town.
You've been listening to As It Happens from CBC, heard across the United States on public radio.
You can also find As It Happens wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Chris Howden. Thanks for listening.
And I'm Neil Kirksall. Goodbye.